You can now find all of C-SPAN's nonfiction-focused podcasts in one place, the C-SPAN Bookshelf feed. Follow now, and you'll get all of C-SPAN's podcasts that are nonfiction book-related every week. I'm Shannon.
And I'm Rachel. And as part of the podcast team here at C-SPAN, we wanted to make it easy for our nonfiction book lovers to access all of our offerings in one place.
Hear from authors like Kidada Williams on her book, I Saw Death Coming, Joan Biskupic and her latest, Nine Black Robes, or Neil King, who shared his walking journey from D.C. to New York City in his book, American Ramble.
Featured programs will include Book Notes Plus, Q&A, Afterwards, and About Books. You can follow the C-SPAN Bookshelf feed wherever you get your podcasts.
In this weekend's episode, three interviews from this week's Washington Journal. First, former Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Florida, David Weinstein, discusses former President Trump's federal documents case and what's next. Then, National Coalition for History's Lee White on the role of the Presidential Records Act in the Trump classified documents case. Plus, Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, the top Republican on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, discusses his proposal to shore up Social Security. We begin with a discussion about former President Trump's arraignment in federal court in Miami earlier this week and what's next in that case.
Joining us from Florida, David Weinstein, former assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Florida, currently a partner in the litigation practice at Jones Walker, here to talk about the next steps when it comes to the events of yesterday. Mr. Weinstein, thanks for your time.
You're welcome. Pleasure to join you and help explain things.
Oh, I really do appreciate it. And let's start by this. What's next steps for both the prosecution and the defense stemming from yesterday?
Well, at this point, the former president has been arraigned. He's entered his not guilty plea and he's asked for discovery from the government. So the next steps for the government is to start handing over the documents, the statements of witnesses and information that they intend to rely upon during the trial, whenever it might take place. Remember that a lot of these documents are classified documents. So on the defense side, the defense team is going to have to submit themselves for background security clearances. They're going to have to be given classified access to classified documents. And then they'll have to set up some sort of a room, a skiff, where the documents will be held and where the defense team can come in, can look at them, and take notes, but they're going to have to leave their notes in that room, so they'll have to create a secure, safe area for defense notes to look at. Interestingly enough, a defendant is entitled to see the evidence against him, so it'll be a question of how we're going to get this process in place and so that the defendant and the defense team can look at things. Sitting on the outside of all this is the co-defendant, Nauta. Remember, yesterday he also had an initial appearance. He did not have his legal team in place, so he's not been arraigned yet. And until he's arraigned as a co-defendant who's been arrested, so to speak, in the case, that speedy trial clock isn't going to start to tick. So the district court judge will not yet have set a trial date. So interesting date for everybody to pay attention to is when Nauta next appears in court with his lawyers and then enters his guilty plea. And then from that point, we'll get the first trial date in this particular matter.
I guess, and you know better than most, that Florida's been known for having a speedy process when it comes to trials. What's the timeline of a potential trial look like there?
Well, if this was a normal case, and we all know it's not a normal case, it would get set for trial, and it will get set for trial until there's a motion to continue within the next 75 days of whenever Nauta is arraigned. So, you know, just over 2 months from perhaps 2 weeks from now, the case will get its first trial setting. The judge will issue a trial order, tell them when their pretrial motions are due, and the case will move forward. In, again, a normal case, there'll be a continuance, maybe a second one. Matter will get set out for the actual trial in about 6 months from now, and then the case would go to trial, it'll be resolved, and that'll be the end of it. Not a normal case. And even in other cases, perhaps it would stretch as long as 9 months until there was either a trial, a change of plea, and then the sentencing. In this particular case, I think we'll be lucky if the pretrial motions are heard within inside the next 9 months. And then from there, if there are adverse hearings to the government that they need to take up on appeal, that's going to go up to the circuit court. And so there'll be more hearings and more delays, and for all quite apparent reasons here. And it looks like the case probably won't be set for an actual trial setting until perhaps summer. And then that's going to be in the midst of the conventions. And so who knows where and when this case will finally get tried.
How does it factor in that you said that Mr. Natwa had not developed a legal defense team? There were reports that the president was having trouble developing a legal defense team. Is there an issue there as far as if you can't have the full complement of people that you need as far as how this gets meted out?
Well, you need to have a lawyer or another two lawyers that are permanently entering notices of appearances to represent you. Now, however else you staff your legal team, whether it's with experts behind the scenes, whether it's with other lawyers who are helping you to prepare the case for trial, that's up to you. But once you have a permanent counsel, and the president has that, it doesn't matter when you get before the judge, you say, well, I haven't assembled the other lawyers on my team. You have a lawyer. And so with Nauta, he needs to get a lawyer, one who's admitted to practice here in the Southern District of Florida, and will enter a permanent notice of appearance. District court judges run a tight rein on their calendar. And if you have a lawyer and the lawyer's entered a permanent appearance, well, then he or she needs to get ready and do whatever it is for the day that the judge says this is when the trial is going to take place.
You talked about the documents and the evidence in question and how that's going to be traded or at least seen by the both sides. Because there are sensitive documents involved, does that mean a certain type of declassification has to happen?
Not necessarily. These documents are still, at least to my knowledge, based on the way they're listed in the counts of the indictment and based on the way they've referred to them. And there are some even continued redactions with regard to the documents' titles within the indictment itself. They're still classified. Now, people are entitled to look at classified documents if they have the proper security clearance. And so what will need to happen is the government lawyers have that security clearance. And if they don't have it now, they certainly had to get it while they were reviewing the documents. But the counsel for the president will have to go through the same screening process. They will be investigated, their backgrounds will be checked and cleared, and then they will be given the appropriate security clearance to look at the documents. But remember, when you get that clearance, you're obligated to look at them and not to take them out of the areas where they're supposed to be. And then you have to closely hold that knowledge. It'll be interesting to see just how we're going to see these documents addressed in a trial or in an evidentiary hearing when the public can't see much, if any at all, of what's on these documents. There are going to certainly have to be potentially hearings that are held outside the presence of the general public. They're often referred to as SEPA hearings with regard to this classified information. So it's going to be interesting, certainly as a side event here, how they're going to continue to treat these documents that are classified. And you're right, they could declassify them now, but remember, that's not going to change the nature of what they were classified at the time that they were possessed by the former president in places outside a secured area.
Judge Aline Cannon, how much of a role does she play going forward?
She plays a very central and pivotal role in this matter. She is the district court judge currently assigned to this matter, and she controls her calendar, her docket, and she is in charge of the pretrial motions and rulings that are made in this matter. Now, she's assisted by a magistrate judge who's paired with her, and she may very well refer much of these preliminary matters and evidentiary hearings to the magistrate judge, and he will conduct the hearings, and then he will make a report and recommendation, but it's up to her to accept his report and recommendation. And she'll be in charge of granting motions to continue. She'll be in charge of ultimately deciding not only these pretrial motions to suppress, motions to dismiss, but other motions that we call motions in limine, meaning limiting certain evidence and testimony that's going to come into the case, certain lines of questioning. And she will be the person who takes the raw palette of evidence that's out there with regard to what's going to be admitted and makes some of the rulings that help determine what's going to fit inside the box. She'll be in charge of the jury selection process. She will ask a lot of the preliminary questions of the members of the potential jury pool. She'll be in charge of scheduling when the trial is going to take place, what hours the trial is going to take place on. And so she plays a pivotal role in this case with regard to getting it to the end point, and that is a trial in this matter.
How much does it matter that she was appointed by the former president and she had a ruling even last year, if I remember correctly, concerning these very documents itself? How much does that matter going forward as far as her possibly being influenced by it all?
You know, we are in uncharted territory of uncharted territory. There are many district court judges, in fact, all of them, who are presidentially appointed and then Senate confirmed. And they sit in these positions until they retire and until they're, you know, no longer an acting district court judge. Obviously, we've never had a defendant who's appeared in front of a judge who they nominated. So it's uncharted with regard to that. Look, when they take the oath of office, any judge, any public official, they agree to uphold the Constitution, which is what put them in that position. And so I have to believe, we all have to believe as part of the justice system that these judges uphold the oath that they take when they sit there. But you're right. We have seen rulings from this judge that were favorable to the defendant already. And that's not unusual in any case. Judges make decisions that are favorable to defendants. They make decisions that are favorable to the government and in civil matters that are favorable or unfavorable to a plaintiff. But in this case, her decisions were reviewed by judges of higher authority, by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. And they took her to task with some of her rulings based on the case law and based on their interpretation of the evidence and sent the matters back and overturned her prior rulings. Now, when I appear in front of a judge and I make a presentation and I argue the case law and the judge disagrees with my interpretation, I have to abide by it, and I can't look at what I've written and what I've said and tell the judge, well, I disagree with you, and I'm going to keep arguing what you've now told me is wrong. And so we have to believe that she will listen to what the 11th Circuit has already said with regard to some of these issues and that her future rulings will be consistent with that. Having said that, if they're not, and if the government can assert or believe under oath in a pleading that they'll have to file that she's already determined some of these issues, that her determinations are biased and prejudiced, they can file a motion to recuse. But up to this point, we haven't seen enough for them to actually do that. Arguably, many people think that they have, others think that they haven't. And so until there's a future ruling that shows some sort of a bias or prejudice, she is believed to be, and we will all have to believe her to be, you know, an impartial arbiter of the facts here and someone who is going to look at the facts, look at the law, look at what the 11th Circuit's already said on many of these issues, both to her and to other judges in cases that have been ruled on, and make a ruling that's consistent with the facts and the law.
That was David Weinstein, former assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Florida. Next, Lee White from the National Coalition for History gives us a 101 on the Presidential Records Act and how it relates to the Trump classified documents case.
Lee White, before we get to the Presidential Records Act of 1978, explain a little bit about the coalition and your group's mission.
Okay, the coalition is a nonprofit, nonpartisan consortium of about 42 different organizations. We represent not just historians, but archivists, political scientists, K through 12 history and social studies teachers, a whole range of different groups. So we advocate on the Hill for funding for history-related agencies and programs like the National Archives, the National Endowment for the Humanities, Park Service history programs, Library of Congress, things like that. But we are also heavily involved in records access issues, since we obviously represent historians who need access to primary sources to do their work.
And it is historycoalition.org if you want to check them out on the web. The Presidential Records Act, our topic, likely going to be hearing more about that as this documents case about the against the former president moves forward. Where did it come from? What was happening in 1978 that we needed a Presidential Records Act?
Well, it was directly the result of the abuses that we saw during the Nixon administration. When President Nixon left, he made a deal with the National Archives was then under the General Services Administration. It's an independent agency now. He made a deal with them to take his tapes and everything with him, and Congress put a stop to it. So Congress realized there was a need to make sure that something like this didn't happen again. So they passed this law called the Presidential Records Act. Up until that time, the records of a president were considered his personal property. So he could take them with him and do whatever he wanted. In the 1930s, just to give you a little more background, because historians like to go back a little further, President Franklin Roosevelt came up with the idea of creating a presidential library where he could leave his records and his mementos and all of the things from his administrations. I think it was during his second administration that he started the idea, so that future historians and people could learn about the work that he had done. Well, that precedent was set, and then each subsequent president decided, oh, I would like to do that too. So the Congress passed a Presidential Libraries Act, I believe in 1955, setting parameters for subsequent presidents to do that. Every president since then has created a presidential library, except for President Obama has decided not to. He was just going to create a presidential center, so the records will revert back to NARA. Normally, the records go to the to a repository at the presidential library.
When you say NARA...
No, I'm sorry. Acronyms creep. The National Archives and Records Administration.
That's so, that independent agency.
Yes.
When we talk about a presidential record, under the Presidential Records Act, what qualifies as a presidential record?
Anything that is created related to the business of the presidency. It covers the White House, that covers the president, it covers the White House staff, the Council of Economic Advisors, all the sub-agencies that are within the immediate purview of the White House. So any business or transactions or documents related to the actual business of the government are presidential records. So it's all-encompassing.
How big of a change was this in 1978 when it was happening, that the records that a president makes, the notes that that he jots down, are no longer his, that they are the property of the United States?
Well, while the president is in office, the president has the authority to do somewhat what they would like to do with records. Like they can, former President Trump has claimed, has said rightly, he can declassify documents when you're president. You can actually destroy records if you want to, but you have to get the advice of the archivist. You have to run it by the archivist and Congress. You have to also notify Congress. So that's not really done that often. They can destroy, you know, bulk mail and things like that. But the moment the new president is inaugurated at 1201 across the street here, the custody reverts to the federal government. And the government owns those records, as well as the American people.
Because it's playing such a role in this debate over the former president's records, does the Presidential Records Act lay out a process for declassification?
That's covered by an executive order. It's Executive Order 13526, if anyone wants to look it up. But declassification is regulated by an executive order, not by the Presidential Records Act.
Does the Presidential Records Act make a distinction between classified records and unclassified records?
No.
Who decides that the Presidential Records Act has been violated? If there's some question over whether something has not been kept, who gets to make that decision?
Well, I think in the case with the National Archives, after President Biden was inaugurated, the National Archives knew there were certain things that were missing, like the Kim Jong-un letter was missing. There were things missing. And it's my understanding that when in classified materials are sent to the president or sent to the office of the president, that they're tracked. They know they exist. And the National Archives was going through, you know, as they're unpacking, they're like, wait, there's things here that are supposed to be here that aren't here. So they noticed it, and they sent letters to the president's office, the former president's office, and said, hey, we got some concerns here. There are records that we think we should have that we don't have. Where are they? Do you have them? If you do, could you please send them back? I mean, they're very deferential, and if you see the timeline throughout the process, the archives was trying gently to prod them, and they were sending emails to the White House counsel, former White House counsel, saying, hey, could you help us out here? I mean, there was not a big in your face. We need this stuff tomorrow. I mean, they were very deferential. They're giving them plenty of time to comply and get the records back to the archives.
Before the Donald Trump case, what were the previous most high profile cases involving the Presidential Records Act?
I don't think this was, well, number one, people should understand there's no enforcement mechanism in the Presidential Records Act at all. President Trump is being prosecuted under the Espionage Act for having possession of records that he's not entitled to have. But there is no code section in the Presidential Records Act that says a violation of this results in 5 years in jail or a $20,000 fine or whatever. The only option the National Archives had once they had played out the we're not getting what we're supposed to be getting was to report it to the Department of Justice and say, hey, he has these records. We believe there are classified records there. You guys need to get involved. So,
has the National Archives and Records Administration involved the Justice Department in any previous cases?
There had been a case where former Clinton National Security Advisor Sandy Berger had actually, I believe he was asked to testify before the 9/11 Commission. It's a little hazy on my memory on it. And he asked the National Archives if he could go in and look at his notes and his records from that time period. And while he was there, he stuffed them in his coat pocket and walked out.
Former President Trump referencing the Clinton case while denouncing the indictment charge against him in recent days. This was an event in Columbus, Georgia this past weekend. I just want to play this clip since we're talking past cases.
Okay.
They also don't mention the defining lawsuit that was brought against Bill Clinton, and it was lost by the government, the famous Sox case that says he can keep his documents. They don't mention that. These are minor details, and that's the ruling law. When I left office and was moving to Florida, boxes were openly sitting on the White House sidewalk. Everybody was taking pictures of them. This isn't somebody smuggling boxes out. Pictures of them, you've all seen. It's sitting with people from GSA and other people waiting to put them on a truck. But they were literally sitting outside of the White House waiting for a truck to come. Then the truck come. It was there for a long time, and they put it in, and they brought it down to Florida. And they make it sound like it's a big, if that's a spy operation or if that's something bad, we did a very poor job, I will tell you. First thing you learn is don't put them on the sidewalk in front of the White House. As a former president, we were negotiating with the National Archives and Records Administration, just as every other president has done. And the next thing I knew, Mar-a-Lago was raided by gun-toting FBI agents. We were negotiating.
That was former President Trump on Saturday. Lee White, to some of the issues he brings up, including the Sox case.
The Sox case is utterly, totally irrelevant to what we have at hand. In that case, President Clinton was being interviewed by a historian, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch, about his time in the White House. One of the exceptions in the Presidential Record Act is that diaries, personal journals are exempt from the Presidential Records Act. So we're not talking, in this case, we're talking about classified documents that were taken from the White House. We're not talking about an interview with a historian. We are talking about highly classified, potentially dangerous documents if they get into the wrong hands. It's apples and oranges. That just doesn't apply.
That was Lee White, executive director of the National Coalition for History. Finally, Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, top Republican on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, discusses his proposal to shore up Social Security.
If nothing is done about Social Security, what does the program look like?
If no one does anything for Social Security, there'll be a guaranteed 24% cut in about 8 or 9 years. So, and somebody, a radio host in Shreveport, Louisiana, Aaron goes, well, that's okay, because I'll already be on and I'll be grandfathered. No, that's not true. Those who are receiving money at that time, and all future beneficiaries, will by law get what amounts to a 24% cut.
That's a lot.
That's if we choose to do nothing, which I'll point out, both President Biden and President Trump's plans are effectively to choose to do nothing. There'll be a 24% cut in that which people are receiving. Obviously, that's terrible. And by the way, that will double poverty among the elderly. So it's just a choice we shouldn't make.
If you're 55 years old and you're listening to what you just said, or are you hearing from folks that are 55 and around that age, I mean, what kind of concern are they expressing?
Well, it's interesting. You've got President Biden and President Trump effectively saying that anyone that wants to do anything about social is making the wrong choice. So they're being kind of, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it by Biden and Trump. So we're not hearing that much, except when you go to people. I had a little video clip. It's on my Twitter account, my Facebook page, and we call it Bill on the Hill. And I went around and spoke to people who were visiting Washington, D.C. And the guy from Pennsylvania, he goes, you know, I've had a lot of jobs that didn't provide retirement. I'm going to need social. A 24% cut? That's going to be terrible. And then there was a doctor from Opelousas, Louisiana, who actually was one of my former residents, but now he's got long gray hair. And he goes, I'm a doctor, by the way, so I used to teach. And he goes, my family, my friends will have to choose between medicine and food. So we know there's going to be terrible consequences. But again, we have two leading presidential candidates that are telling the American people, if anybody wants to address it, they're wrong. We're choosing to do nothing. And that means they're choosing that people will have to choose between medicine and food.
We were just listening to callers in our first half an hour who are already making those decisions. And then we heard a couple callers talk about they paid off their homes. They retired, they paid off their homes, but they're seeing those property taxes on top of these other costs go up so unexpectedly that is really cutting into their Social Security check now.
So I'm told that if you're currently 60 in good health, you got a 50% chance of living to be 90. That's important for a couple of reasons. One, isn't it great that we're living longer? But some folks are going to live beyond their ability to work. So even if you choose to work after retiring, you get to 80, you can't work any longer. So when Trump and Biden choose to do nothing, they're saying to those folks who are going to live beyond their ability to work, you're going into poverty. We want to get elected, so we're going to pretend that there's nothing that needs to be done, and you're going to go into poverty, and they don't care.
So let's talk about what you want to do. This is what you're proposing. Would place $1.5 trillion over 5 years in an investment fund separate from the Social Security Trust Fund. Hold this investment in escrow for 70 years. Aims for an average of about 3.5% equity premium over the 70-year escrow period. And that would cover up to 75% of the projected shortfall is what you're saying. Some might get concerned that you are putting Social Security and putting it at the whim of the market.
Boy, am I glad you asked that. Because you answered it in the way you put it. This fund is separate from Social Security. It doesn't take Social Security dollars at all. It takes money separate. And we can raise that however we wish. There's so many empty buildings the federal government owns. We estimate there's $20 billion worth of empty federal buildings. Sell off a portion of that, you would be able to fund the $1.5 trillion, do a lot of other good things too. And so you fund it, and it grows separately. We would repeal the law that says that current beneficiaries get a 24% cut. So we actually guarantee the promised benefit that right now is going to be cut by almost a fourth. And we're betting on the strength of the American economy. We don't place any risk upon the beneficiary. If the market goes up and the market goes down, that risk is in the fund itself. But we know over 70 years, if history is any prologue, that it's going to do okay. And that's how we take care of 75% of the debt.
Why not do the other proposals that have been on the table, capping Social Security, et cetera, raising the age? Those other, take them each of those proposals and tell us why you wouldn't do that.
Well, first, you should not raise taxes on seniors. You should not decrease benefits for seniors, period, end of story. Two-fifths of baby boomers are their only retirement plan is Social Security. So if you go to them and say, by the way, we're going to raise your taxes or we're going to decrease your benefits, it's just a non-starter. It's just a non-starter. So you just can't go there. Politically, you can't, but also morally, you can't. Now, maybe you can raise the age of eligibility for someone who's currently 30 years old. Okay, that would have to be on the table. There's still 25% of the benefit we have to address. That's why we need presidential leadership. We need a president who's actually honest to the American people, not giving them happy talk in the hope to get elected by giving them happy talk, but being a leader and saying, listen, we still got 25% we have to address. How do we do it without affecting those who are retired or approaching retirement? And let's do it in a way that we politically find that we can do it. Now, by the way, if all you want to do is raise your taxes, that's incredibly regressive. It falls heavily upon those who make the least in our society. That's wrong. If all you want to do is raise the age of eligibility, you got to raise it pretty far. So you've got to have a proposal which actually is rooted in reality. We feel like ours is rooted in reality.
That was Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican of Louisiana. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.